This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 3, given in Stuttgart on October 5, 1922. Today, to lay a foundation for the next few days, I shall speak about the spirit in the most concrete way. I must call on you to try to develop a real feeling for what is meant here by spirit. What is taken into consideration by a being today? People attach importance only to what they experience consciously from the time they wake up in the morning until they go to sleep at night. They reckon as part of the world only what they experience in their waking consciousness. If you were listening to the voice of the present and had accustomed yourself to it, you might say, "Yes, but was it not always so? Did human beings in earlier times include anything else in what they understood by reality than what they experienced in their waking consciousness?" I certainly do not wish to create the impression that we ought to go back to the conditions in earlier epochs of civilization. That is not my intention. The thing that matters is to go forward, not backward. But in order to find our bearings, we may turn back, look back, rather, beyond the time of the 15th century, before the age I attempted to describe so energetically to you yesterday. What people of that time said about the world is looked upon today as mere fantasy, as not belonging to reality. You need only look at the literature of ancient times, and you will find that when people spoke of salt, mercury, phosphorus, and so on, that they included many things in what they meant that people are anxious to exclude today. People say today, "Yes, in those days people added something out of their own imagination when they spoke of salt, mercury, phosphorus." We do not want to argue about why this is so fearfully excluded today. But we must realize that human beings saw something in phosphorus, in addition to what is seen by the mere senses, in the way modern people see color. It was surrounded by a spiritual etheric aura, just as around the whole of nature there seemed to hover a spiritual etheric aura, even though since the 4th or 5th century CE it was very colorless and pale. Even so, human beings were still able to see it. It was as little the outcome of fantasy as the red color we see today. They actually saw it. Why were they able to see this aura? Because something streamed out to them from their experiences during sleep. In the waking consciousness of that time, people did not experience in salt, sulfur, or phosphorus any more than they do today. But when the people in those days woke up, sleep had not been unfruitful for their souls. Sleep still worked over into the day, and their perception was richer. Their experience of everything around them was more intense. Without this knowledge as a basis, we cannot understand earlier times. Later on, the experience of the ancients, in connection with sulfur, phosphorus, and so on, became a mere name, an abstraction. The spirit continued as an abstraction in tradition, until at the end of the 19th century, one could not grasp the spirit in one's thinking, or at least one could not sense it. External culture, which alleges such great progress, naturally attaches the greatest importance to the fact that human beings act upon it with their waking consciousness. Naturally, with this, they will build machines, but with their waking consciousness they can work very little upon their own nature. If we were obliged always to be awake, we should very soon become old, at least by the end of our 20th year, and more repulsively old than old people are today. We cannot always be awake, because the forces we need to work inwardly upon our organism are experienced within us only during sleep. It is, of course, true that human beings can work on outer culture when they are awake, but only in sleeping consciousness can they work upon themselves. And in olden times, much streamed over from sleeping consciousness into the waking state. That is the great change that took place in the middle of the 15th century. This trickling of sleep consciousness into waking consciousness ceased. Pictorially, I would say, in the 10th and 11th centuries of Western civilization, human beings still woke up in such a way that they felt divine spiritual powers perform deeds within me between my going to sleep and waking up. They felt the influx of divine spiritual forces. Just as in waking consciousness, they experienced the streaming in of the health-bringing light of the sun. And before going to sleep, there was in every human being an elemental mood of prayer, full of nature forces. People entered sleep, or if they were people of knowledge, they at least strove to do so, by giving themselves over to divine spiritual powers. The education of those who were destined for the spiritual life was such that this mood was deliberately cultivated. At the end of the 19th century, those who regarded themselves as the most spiritual had for a long time replaced this by another method of preparation. I have often witnessed how people prepare themselves for sleep. I must take my fill of beer to prepare for sleep. This sounds ludicrous, yet we see it is historically true that vision into the spiritual world through sleep was a deliberate and conscious striving among human beings of past epochs, apart from the fact that the candidates for initiation, the students of olden days, were prepared in a sacred way for the temple sleep, in which they were made aware of the human being's participation in the spiritual world. At the present time, when people consider the development of civilization, they do not ask, how has it affected humanity educationally? The question is not asked, because people do not think of the human being as a whole, but only in part. One has a strange impression if one sees a little further than the nearest spiritual horizon. People believe they know the truth about certain things at last, whereas the people of old were altogether childish. Read any current history of physics. You will find that it is written as if everything before this age were naive. Now, at last, things have been perceived in the form in which they can remain permanently. A sharp line is drawn between what has been achieved today and the ideas of nature evolved in quotes, childish times. No one thinks of asking, what educational effect does the science that is absorbed today have from the point of view of world historical progress? Let us think of some earlier book on natural science. From the modern point of view, it is childish. But now let us put aside the modern point of view and ask, what educational effect had such a book at that time, and what effect has a modern book? The modern book may be very clever, and the older one very fantastic, but if we consider the educational value as a whole, we shall have to admit that when a book was read, it was not so easy to read books in those days, there was something ceremonial about it. It drew something out of the depths of people's souls. The reading of a book was actually like the process of growing. Productive forces were released in the organism, and human beings felt these productive forces. They felt that something real was there. Today, everything is logical and formal. Everything is assimilated by means of the head, formally and intellectually, but no will force is involved. And because it is all assimilated only by the head, and is thus entirely dependent upon the physical head organization, it remains unfruitful for the development of the true human being. Today, people struggle against materialism. It would be almost more sensible if they did not. For what does materialism affirm? It asserts that thinking is a product of the brain. Modern thinking is a product of the brain. That is precisely the secret, that modern thinking is a product of the brain. With regard to modern thinking, materialism is quite right, but it is not right about thinking, as it was before the middle of the 15th century. At that time, people did not think only with the brain, but with what was alive within the brain. People had living concepts. The concepts of that time gave the same impression as an anthill. They were all alive. Modern concepts are dead. Modern thinking is clever, but dreadfully comfortable. Human beings do not feel the thinking, and the less they feel it, the more they love it. In earlier times, they felt a tingling when they were thinking, because thinking was a reality of the soul. Now, people are made to believe that thinking was always as it is today. But modern thinking is a product of the brain. Earlier thinking was not. We ought to be grateful to the materialists for drawing attention to the fact that contemporary thinking is dependent upon the brain. Such is the truth. And this matter is much more serious than is usually imagined. People believe that materialism is a false worldview. That is not at all true. Materialism is a product of world evolution, but a dead product, describing life in the condition where life has already died. This thinking, which has evolved more and more since the 15th century, and which has entrenched itself, above all in Western cultures, has quite definite characteristics. The Eastern cultures, despite still, after all, preserve the old thinking. But the further west we go, the more a way of thinking takes the upper hand that the people of the Eastern civilizations regard as inferior. It does not impress people of the East at all. They despise it. However, they themselves have nothing new, but only the old thinking that is perishing. Europeans, and more so the Americans, do not feel at ease when they have to enter into the thinking of the Vedas. They think of thinking, that kind of thinking makes them tingle in the brain. Westerners love dead thinking, where they do not notice at all that they are thinking. Today, not only when someone is talking nonsense, but also when they are talking about living things, Western people confess that a mill wheel is turning in their heads. They do not want what is living. They merely want to snatch at what is dead. Here is an example that I am giving only out of cultural interest, not polemics. I described how it is possible to see an aura of colors around stones, plants, and animals. The way in which I put this is in the book titled How to Know Higher Worlds was such that it made living thinking, not dead thinking, a necessity. A short time ago, a proper contemporary professor at a university, who was supposed to have something to do with philosophy, came across this description. For him it is impossible to think livingly. He cannot do it, and so for him it does not exist. And there is supposed to be an aura of colors around stone, plant, and animal. He has seen colors only in the solar spectrum, and so he thinks that I, too, can only have seen them in the solar spectrum, and have transferred them to stone, plant, and animal. This professor cannot in the least follow my way of describing, so he calls it just a torrent of words. For him it is indeed a torrent of words. He cannot understand any of it. And for a great number of university professors it is the same. A mill wheel is going round in their heads. So, quickly, away with the head. Then, of course, nothing can possibly come out of it. Living human beings, however, demand a living thinking, and this demand is in their very blood. You must be clear about this. You must make your head so strong again that it can stand not only logical abstract thinking, but also living thinking. You must not immediately get a buzzing head when you are to think living thoughts. Dead thinking was for the materialistic education of the West, for those whose characteristic was pure intellectualism. But if you look into it, you discover a very dubious perspective. The earlier thinking could be carried over into sleep. Then one was still something in sleep. Human beings were beings among other beings. They were something, real entities, during sleep, because they had carried living thinking with them into it. They brought living thinking out of sleep when they woke up and took it back with them when they fell asleep. Modern thinking is bound to the brain, and this cannot help us during sleep. Today, therefore, in accordance with modern science, We can be the cleverest and most learned people, but only during the day. We cease to be clever during the night, when we face that world through which we might work upon our own being. For this reason, human beings have stopped working on themselves. With the concepts we evolve from the time of waking to that of sleeping, we can achieve something only between waking and sleeping. We cannot accomplish anything on the human being. People must work out of the forces with which they build up their own being. During the period when human beings must work the most to build themselves up, when they are little children, they need the greatest amount of sleep. If ever a method should be discovered for cramming into babies all that is taught to 17- and 18-year-olds, you would soon see what they would look like. It is a very good thing that babies are cared for at the mother's breast and not from the lecture podium. It is out of sleep that people must bring the forces through which they can work upon their own being. We can carry into sleep nothing from the concepts we build through science, through external observation and experiments and the controlling of experiments. Nor can we bring anything of what is developed in sleep into the concepts of the material world. The spiritual and the intellectual do not get on well together unless united in the world of full consciousness. Formerly this union was brought about in a more subconscious way. Today it must be done with full consciousness, and humanity does not wish to turn to this today. What happened when people of earlier times passed with their souls into sleep? They were still somebody, because they had within them what hovers around things, what we call today a, in quotes, fantasy. They bore this into sleep. Human beings could still hold their own outside the physical body in the spiritual world. Formerly, they were somebody in the spiritual world between going to sleep and waking up. Today, people are less and less of a real entity. They are nearly absorbed by the spirituality of nature when they leave their bodies in going to sleep. In true perception of the world, this is at once evident to the soul. You just must see it. And you will be able to see it when you acquire for yourselves the necessary vision for these things. Humanity must attain this vision, for we are living in an age when it can no longer be said that it is impossible to speak of the spirit as we speak of animals or stones. With such faculties of vision, you will be able to see that even though Caesar was not very portly in physical life, yet when his soul left his body in sleep, it was of a considerable, in quotes, size, not in the spatial sense, but its greatness could be experienced. His soul was majestic. A person today may be one of the most portly of bankers, but when his soul steps out of his body, in sleep, into the spirituality of nature, you should see what a ghastly, shrunken framework it becomes. The portly banker becomes quite an insignificant figure. Since the last third of the 19th century, humanity has really been suffering from spiritual undernourishment. The intellect does not nourish the spirit. It only distends it. That is why human beings take no spirituality with them into sleep. They are nearly sucked up when they stretch out into the world of spiritual nature, between sleeping and waking, as a thin soul skeleton. That is why the question of materialism is far from theoretical. Nothing is of less importance today than the theoretical strife between materialism, spiritualism, and idealism. These things are of no consequence, for the refutation of materialism achieves nothing. We may refute materialism as often as we like. Nothing will come of it. For in the end, the reasons we bring in order to refute it are just as materialistic as those we bring for or against idealism. Theoretical refutations achieve nothing one way or the other. But what really matters is that we have spirit once again in our whole way of looking at the world. Then our concepts will regain the force to nourish our being. To make this clear, let me say the following. Now, I really do not find any very good difference between those people who call themselves materialists and those who, in little sectarian circles, call themselves, let us say, theosophists. For the way in which the one makes out a case for materialism and the other for theosophy is by no means essentially different. If people want to make a case for theosophy with thinking entirely dependent upon the brain, then even theosophy is materialistic. It is not a question of the words one uses, but whether spirit is in the words spoken. When I compare much of the theosophical twaddle with Haeckel's thought, I find the spirit in Haeckel, whereas the theosophists speak of the spirit as if it were matter, but only diluted matter. The point is not to speak about the spirit, but to speak through the spirit. One can speak spiritually about the material. That is to say, it is possible to speak about the material in mobile concepts. That is always much more spiritual than to speak unspiritually about the spirit. Even when many come forward today with every possible kind of logical argument in defense of the spiritual view of the world, it simply does not help us. It does not help one bit. During the night, we remain just as barren if during the day we think about hydrogen, chlorine, bromine, iodine, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, silica, potassium, sodium, and so on, and then construct our theories, as when we think about the human being consisting of physical, etheric, and astral bodies. It is all the same as far as what is living is concerned. To speak in a living way about potassium or calcium, to do living chemistry, is much more valuable than doing a dead intellectual theosophy. For theosophy, too, can be done in a dead intellectual way. It does not really matter whether we speak materialistically or intellectually, but what matters is that the spirit shall be in what we say. The spirit must penetrate us with its livingness. However, because human beings no longer understand this, it is most disagreeable to them when anyone gets serious with it. I did this in one of my last Oxford lectures, and to make myself quite clear, I said, "It is all the same to me whether people speak of spiritualism, realism, idealism, materialism, or anything else. When I need language to describe some external phenomenon, I use materialistic language. This can be done in such a way that the spirit too lives within it. If one speaks out of the realm of the spirit, what one says will be spiritual, even though the language may have materialistic form. That is the difference between what is cultivated here as anthroposophy and what is pursued in other places under similar names. Every few weeks, books against anthroposophy are brought out. They contain statements that are supposed to be leveled against what I have said, but what they attack is always quite new to me, for as a rule, I have never said such things. They collect all sorts of rubbish and then print voluminous books about it. What they attack is usually nothing whatever to do with what I actually say. The point is not to fight materialism, but to see to it that our concepts come out of the world of the spirit, that they are really experienced, that they are concepts filled with life. What is here presented and accepted as anthroposophy is quite different from what the world says about it. Today people fight against anthroposophy, and sometimes also for it, quite materialistically, unspiritually, while what really matters is that we get down to experiencing the spirit. People then begin not to be able to get it right in their heads, for when one begins to speak of spiritual beings as one speaks of plants and animals in the physical world, people take one for a fool. I can understand that, because there is a little thing that is overlooked. It consists of the fact that this folly is the true reality, the actual living reality for human beings. The other kind of reality is good for machines, but not for human beings. This is what I wanted to say clearly. In what I intend here, and have always intended, the important thing is not merely to speak about the spirit, but to speak out of the spirit, to unfold the spirit in one's very speaking. This is then the spirit that can have an educational effect upon our dead cultural life. The spirit must be the lightning that strikes into our dead culture and kindles it to renewed life. Therefore, do not think that you will find here any plea for rigid concepts, such as the concepts physical body, etheric body, astral body, which are so nicely arrayed on the walls of theosophical groups, and are pointed out just as in a lecture room sodium, potassium, and so on are pointed to with their atomic weights. There is no difference between pointing at tables, giving the atomic weight of potassium, and pointing to the etheric body. It does not matter at all. That is not the point. In this sense, this kind of theosophy, or even anthroposophy, is not new, but merely the latest product of the old. One can hear the most incredible nonsense when people suddenly feel themselves called upon to represent the spirit. I do not mention these things as criticism, but as a symptom. I will tell you two stories. The first runs as follows. I was once at a meeting somewhere in Western Europe on the subject of theosophy. After the lectures had come to an end, I came into conversation with someone about the value of these lectures. This personality, who was a good disciple of the theosophical sectarianism that had taken place there, told me of his impression of the lectures in these words, quote, "There are such beautiful vibrations in this hall," close quote. The feeling of well-being, you see, was expressed in terms of vibrations, in other words, materialistically. Another time, people pestered me about some discovery that had suddenly been made on the spiritual plane. It was stated that repeated earthly lives, which as a matter of fact can only be revealed to the soul by genuinely spiritual perception, must also be perceived in an earthly guise, must be clothed in terms of materialistic thinking. So these people began to speak of the, quote, "permanent atom," close quote, which goes through all earthly lives. They said, if I am now living on the earth and come back again after hundreds of years, the atoms will be scattered to the four winds, but one single atom goes over into the next life on earth. It was called the permanent atom. Quite happily, the most materialistic ideas were being introduced into the truth of repeated earthly lives, into a truth that can only be grasped by the spirit. As if it could profit anyone to have a single atom, say from the 4th or 5th century, going around in one's brain. Surely it is the same as if there were a surgeon in the world, beyond who had managed to equip me in this life by having preserved my stomach from a former incarnation and having inserted it in my present body. In principle, these things are exactly the same. I am not telling you this as a joke, but as an interesting symptom of people who, wanting to speak of the spirit, talk of the pleasant sensation coming from the spiritual, in quotes, vibrations, or have only absorbed through thought imitations what others know about repeated earthly lives, and then clothe this in such a way that they talk about the permanent atom. Books have been written, even by theosophists, about this permanent atom. Books with curious drawings showing the structure of hydrogen, oxygen, chlorine atoms, and so on. And when one looks at them, they are no less horrible than the sketches that materialists have made of the atoms. It does not matter whether we say that this is spiritual or that is material. What matters is to realize the necessity of entering into the living spirit. I do not say this in a polemic sense, but to make it clear to you. In this sense, the following is extraordinarily characteristic. There lives at the present time a very gifted Benedictine father named Magyar, M-A-G-E-R, one of the finest minds in the order, and the Benedictines have basically the best minds. Magyar has written an extremely interesting little book titled The Behavior of the Human Being in the Presence of God. It belongs, in thought, to the time when Benedict founded his order. Had it been written then, it would have been quite in accordance with the times. When someone reads a book called The Behavior of the Human Being in the Presence of God, one can admire it, and I do admire it. The same priest has, however, also given his opinion on anthroposophy. and now he becomes the densest of materialists. It is really terribly difficult to characterize what he maintains when one has first to enter into such a rigid kind of thought. What he rebukes most is that the perception in imaginative knowledge, which I put first when it comes to content, is of such a nature that for Father Majer it amounts to mere pictures. He gets no farther. And then he says, in accordance with his scientific conscience, that anthroposophy materializes the world. He takes terrible exception to the fact that anthroposophy materializes the world. In other words, that anthroposophy does not confine itself to the unreal, abstract concepts he loves. For there one loves the most abstract concepts. Just read a Catholic philosophy and you will find being, becoming, existence, beauty, and so on, all in the greatest abstractions. Whatever you do, do not touch the world. And the Father notices that anthroposophy contains living concepts, which can actually come down to real things, to the real world. That is an abomination to him. One ought to answer him, if knowledge is to have anything real, it must follow the course taken by God with the world. This course started from the spiritual and always materialized. The world was first spiritual and then became more and more material, so that real knowledge must follow this course. It is not sought for in anthroposophy, but one comes to it. The picture clicks into reality. But Father Majer criticizes this. And yet it is exactly what he must himself believe if he wants to give his faith a reasonable content. However, in our case, he calls it the materialization of knowledge. Of course, there is no satisfying those who insist, for heaven's sake, no living concepts, for they will slip into reality. Then we would have to say, stay far away. So let me read that again. Then we would have to stay far away from that with our concepts. In such cases, we can have only concepts belonging to waking consciousness and none that are capable of working upon the human being from out of the spiritual world. But that is what we need. We need a living evolution and a living education of humanity. A fully conscious human being feels the culture of the present day to be cold and arid. It must be given life and inner activity once again. It must become such that it fills human beings, fills them with life. Only this can lead us to the point where we shall no longer have to confess that we ought not to mention the Spirit. It can lead us to where good will flows into us and develops within us the inclination not for abstract speaking, but for inward action in the Spirit that flows into us, not for obscure, nebulous mysticism, but for the courageous, energetic permeation of our own being with spirituality. Permeated by spirit, we can speak of matter. We shall not be led astray when talking of important material discoveries, because we are able to speak about them in a spiritual way. We shall shape what we sense darkly within us as an urge forward into a force that educates humanity. Tomorrow we will speak further about these things. The end of Lecture 3.